Hello and bora da. My name is Diana Dee. I'm a senior lecturer at Cardiff University and I'm also an alumni of the Council of Deans First Fellowship Scheme. I'm recording this podcast here from Wales and I'm proud to have been involved in the developmental and the fundamental stages of the Welsh Government's Anti-Racist Wales Action Plan. I have a keen interest in all aspects of diversity matters and it is my privilege to lead today's podcast, which is timely as it forms part of the Council of Deans Health series of resources, which is being shared as part of Race Equity Month in November. We know that racism and discrimination are key challenges in health and social care, with widening ranges of implications for workplace culture, recruitment and retention, and the delivery of patient care. To achieve racial equality in healthcare, anti-racism must be embedded from the beginning, including within healthcare workforce learning and the development of that as well. This session will explore the anti-racist agenda in Wales through its Anti-Racist Wales Action Plan and its application in both health and social care. I shall speak to colleagues in Welsh Government who I've been working with as part of a representation from the Council as proposing a framework of anti-racism learning and development for all healthcare staff and students, and to discuss how HEIs can support this agenda. I'll now introduce you to Professor Anton Emmanuel, who recently joined the NHS Wales Shared Service Partnership earlier in May this year. Anton has previously led NHS England's Workforce Race Equality Standard, which is called the WRES programme, and now he's working with colleagues here in Wales to lead WRES here with the Welsh Government. Thank you for joining us today, Anton.
York and Borda, and many thanks for the invitation.
Fabulous. So if you could share with listeners then, what is an anti-racist approach? Why should it be adopted within healthcare learning and development?
Yes. So an anti-racist approach is one which acknowledges that it begins by acknowledging that we work and live in an institutionally racist system. If you don't accept that, then you are maybe non-racist, but you're certainly not anti-racist. Anti-racism involves accepting the privilege people have. I have the privilege of being a man, and that means that if I begin with that, I can accept that and understand where there's misogyny. If you are not minoritized and you don't believe we have systemically oppressive systems which discriminate against ethnic minority people, then you cannot be anti-racist. And if you are not anti-racist, then you're perpetuating that system of inequity, which is bad for staff. It's bad for the Black and Asian staff, but it's also bad for the white staff. And much, much, much more importantly, it's bad for patients and public outcomes. So, you know, being anti-racist is not an optional extra. It's not something nice to do if we have time after the pandemic or after the financial crisis. It's something we have to be part of if we actually genuinely care about health outcomes for our patients and staff before that.
Great. So that forms part of the context about the agenda then. So what is the Anti-Racist Wales Action Plan, and what anti-racist goals have health and social care in Wales committed to then?
Well, first I'd say kudos to you, Diana, and to all the colleagues you worked with, because for me, the reason I came across Severn Bridge to work with the Welsh Government was because I think the approach that the Anti-Racist Action Plan takes is the correct one, but it's also unique. And I've done a certain amount of reading around this. Of all the countries in the world, there is no other country which has declared itself in this way. It's an extraordinary thing for Wales to do. It's the correct thing to do. And what it does is to begin with that acknowledgement of the fact that we do have a system which is in processes and thoughts discriminatory against Black and Asian people. And so the action plan begins from that starting point. And it says that what we've got to do is to look at all our systems, not just health, which we're talking about today, but also in justice and education and housing and all of the aspects, and apply our lens to all our processes to collect data to identify where the particular challenges are, and then to take corrective actions based on that. So it's to ensure that we understand what we're doing and where we need to do it very specifically. So the action plan is exactly that. It's a plan rather than a theoretical strategy based on academia. It's something which is very much a hands-on deliverable to say, we're going to focus on changing our systems, these systems which perpetuate the inequality.
Mm-hmm. It's great to hear that Wales is leading the way on that as well. Mm-hmm. And that it is, and I agree with you that it is all-encompassing. It's ambitious, the plan, but it's good to see that it's all-encompassing. There's lots of strands that are covered within that.
Well, I think that's exactly right, because I think the point about this is that, I mean, of course, in some ways, there's an imperative in health because of the outcomes of people's well-being. There's also mm-hmm. an imperative in health because we are the largest employer in Wales, the NHS is the largest employer in the UK. And therefore, if we get it right here, we can get it right across the piece, hopefully, or at least learn lessons. And there's also this thing about, you know, as you're implying, you know, the rising tide lifts all the boats. So if we do this right for race, we'll do it right for all other inequalities, and we'll do it right across the whole country potentially. So I think I don't want to get over ahead of ourselves, but I think there is an opportunity to do something dynamic and impactful. 2030 is ambitious, mm-hmm. and it's good mm-hmm. to have a line to aim for. But I think, you know, we have to, as long as we're making progress towards goals in a real sense, then the time becomes something which, mm-hmm. I think, if you look at the evidence of anti-racism in other places where it's worked in isolation, it's sort of a rolling stone. Once you get the inertia and momentum started, the pace of change actually feeds itself. So we could mm-hmm. do something big and important here. Mm-hmm.
In the wider context of inclusivity, isn't it? Excellent. So you mentioned objectives, but can we be clear then, what are the main aims of the anti-racist learning and development framework?
So I think we need to understand that racism or any discrimination begins through these bad processes. It's then perpetuated by our leadership who continue those processes and in some way almost feed them, or at the very least turn a blind eye to inequality. So the framework has to begin by recognizing that there is a systematized problem which is driven by leadership. Now, education on its own is not the solution to these problems. It's critically important for people to understand things, but what's become clear in every bit of data that's ever been looked at is that if you just do training on unconscious bias or whatever else you want to call it, you don't get things delivered. So training has to be targeted at thinking about changing actions rather than just educating somebody about the problems. Because otherwise what you end up with, a badly done framework, is one which makes people conscious of the problems, but then leaves them still working in rubbish systems. So you end up with somebody who's awakened to the challenge but can't change it. So you have to involve leadership in that. And the educational framework, the whole modulus function of it is to say there's some foundational learning everyone has to have. But then according to whether you're an HR director, whether you're an executive, whether you're a middle grade manager, whether you're a person who's another stage of the pyramid, you then have to have a layer of educational part of the framework directed towards you and the work you do. So it's very much about thinking about the kind of foundational parts, but then the parts which are much more bespoke to the individual, but contextualizing all that educational stuff in the act of changing the process rather than just learning for your own benefit.
So to give us a little bit more insight into the training that you've just mentioned, what kind of content then will colleagues be expecting to see within that anti-racism awareness e-learning module that's being developed here in Wales?
So there's a certain element which is maybe seems a bit dry but necessary in some ways, which is the part around language. So people are familiar with the idea of anti-racism and non-racism and trying to help with that. The idea of some of the terminology that's really misused by the media in a conscious, deliberate way, things around, you know, privilege and people being called, said to be woke and all this. So a lot of this stuff is around understanding the language. Another very key part, forgetting that, is that we have to understand that the experience of people varies by ethnicity. The idea of lumping people together as BME is bonkers. Mm-hmm. I speak as somebody who's an African man, and the idea that my experience is the same as that of a Chinese colleague, as that of a Filipino colleague, is nonsensical. So we have to be able to disaggregate our data and ethnicity. We also need to critically understand the true meaning of intersectionality. And that's another core component of the module, to understand that there's an additive burden if you're both, say, Black and a woman, if you're both Filipino and low paid, if you're both Bangladeshi and a single mom. There are a set of these intersections. People tend to misuse this concept of intersectionality as saying, oh, well, don't forget about disability, don't forget about religion. And that's a misunderstanding of the concept. And so part of education is to help colleagues understand that there's an additive burden that people carry by virtue of having these different characteristics. So there's that kind of sort of foundational stuff. Beyond that, there's then the idea of how you can, what can you do? I think learning, for me anyway, and that's why we've been very heavily involved with this, has to be something which you can carry away to practically change. The idea of learning for its own sake is not a luxury we have in government, I don't think. You know, people can read a library book, can watch a video, listen to a podcast and learn. But I think what we're trying to do with the module is to also directly link in, what are you going to take from this to change in practice tomorrow, whatever level you're at? Is it that you're going to now say, look at our data more carefully, look at our processes of HR, we look at how we recruit people, how we offer stretch or secondment opportunities. What are you going to take directly from this? Is that so? That's a lot of talking by me, sorry, but I'm trying to sort of give that idea that what we're trying to do is to tailor education according to the level the person is working at, to understand subtleties of this and how it interconnects into real life. And the final part is to give people a sort of education about the data that's coming. So as you mentioned, we're involved in doing a workforce risk quality standard data collection that's going to be annualized as part of the action planning of how organizations take equity actions. And we're going to help educate colleagues in saying, what does this mean when you get this proportion or that likelihood ratio? Well, so that's quite an ambitious set of things to do. Mm-hmm. Long answer to a very simple question, sorry.
But very significant and important, isn't it? You know, we want to know that data collection is going to be meaningful, isn't it? For me, you mentioned intersectionality. For somebody like me, you know, it's very easy to relate to intersectionality. Mm-hmm. But will privilege be something else that will be included?
Well, the idea that you can be an ally, a genuine ally, without understanding your privilege is just obviously for the birds. So really understanding that we have these, and I was saying, I have a privilege of being a man. That wasn't earned by me. Mm-hmm. I just happened to be born with those particular attributes, and the world turns to my tune on that basis. I happen not to have any disability. That's my good fortune. So understanding that privilege is deeply critical to actually genuinely being an ally. And that's ultimately, I slightly turn my eyes a bit when people talk about allyship and all this, because I think, oh, it's often a bit performative. And so I think if people who don't, so privilege is therefore, if you don't own privilege and the privilege you have, then, you know, you're never going to be an effective ally, because you'll always undermine your actions by thinking, well, yeah, you know, but I was able to do this, or I was able to do that, and that's good for you, but it isn't necessarily about you, it's about the good fortune you had. So yeah, privilege is a really critical component of.
And that links back to things like unconscious bias as well, doesn't it? So it's important. Okay, so what more can HEIs or VCs, the council, do to promote anti-racism? What does best practice look like? And can you give me any exemplars, perhaps?
A lot, I'd say. So beyond obviously doing the kind of mandatory bits of this in terms of data collection and the educational access and so on, we can change lots of our things. We can really understand our processes. How do we get the staff we've got? Look at our HR processes. How do we do appraisals for how people progress? How do we look at grant funding? What opportunities to give those colleagues? Are we really looking at everything we do in an anti-racist lens? Or are there certain parts we think, oh, that's how we've always done it, or that would really disrupt the system? And if you are doing that, if you think something's sacred and exempt from that, then you're not really anti-racist. You may be doing very well, but you're not fully there. So there's an imperative to look at all our processes that we supervise. There's also something about understanding a term, another term I really dislike, but it's in common parlance, of so-called microaggressions. because when minoritized person experiences these so-called aggressions, they're not micro, they are painful in that moment. You may choose to shrug them off.
The impact.
You know, but so the micro is in the eye of the beholder rather than the person who's experienced it. Recognizing that, so how do your students, how do your staff, especially the junior staff, how do they get to complain? What is their speaking up opportunity in safety without threatening their careers or their education? What systems do you have in place to really ensure that you are capturing the cultural things that your people experience? Is it that, well, oh, so-and-so does behave like that, but we know he's a great lecturer or he's a great research asset or whatever else. That isn't acceptable. So how do we capture the cultural things? Do you have a survey which you collate data about people's experience based on their characteristics? If you do so, do you then analyze that by those characteristics specifically? Athena Swan caused great changes and improvements because people were forced to look at things in a very particular lens. Race equality is as important as any other equality. So it's about looking at the data and the opportunities in that way. There's also the thing then, sorry, it's locked here. If you're in a healthcare setting, I think there's a real imperative to look at how you recruit patients. You know, how do your chief investigators recruit patients? We know that all the big trials, and they're last ago, I work in University College London, where my chair is. You know, when we look at our processes there, the people we recruit are not representative of our patients that we have where we live or the tertiary care we offer. So what are we doing to get that experience, to be really reaching into that? So there's a ton of things we can be doing beyond the mandatory.
Yeah, so lots of things you've picked up on about community engagement that follows NICE guidance. You talked about representation, which is something that's really important to myself and in my line of work. And you talked about ensuring that people are listened to if they do raise any discrimination cases, etc. But also we also need to work well together to encourage that as well, to people, to give them a voice to speak up about discrimination and racial discrimination as well.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think you summarised that much more elegantly than I was rambling through.
Well, that comes to an end then. Thank you, Anton, for your time today. And I also want to thank the audience for listening. Can I also remind listeners that we will be sharing more of the podcasts all throughout November, as well as webinars, interviews and blogs, to find out more and engage with others using the hashtag Race Equity Month on Twitter. Thank you.